Good afternoon. This is Sarah Wright with some special programming for the next half hour. We've had a lot of schedule changes lately due to the impeachment and trial. Today we're preempting Making Contact for a special interview I recorded with Congressman Jared Huffman on Monday. He was taking a trip through Willits, so we sat down in a conference room at City Hall to talk about the civic organizations he'd visited, as well as regional issues like the Potter Valley Project, fisheries disaster relief, and a look back at the role of some federal agencies in recent fires. And because the live interview we'd originally planned was preempted by the impeachment, we touched on national politics and federal issues like cannabis, protection of waterways, and the shortcomings of executive orders.
Happy to be with you here in Willits.
And what have you been up to in Willits? I heard you went to the high school and the hospital today.
It's a whirlwind day here. Started with a great visit with several dozen members of the high school, including the academic decathlon team, which has just brought home a second place regional finish. They're going to go off to the state finals here in a few weeks. And so Willits is punching above its weight when it comes to high school academics. But we had a great little student town hall, and I was then able to visit with most of your city council and your city manager just to kind of check in and see what's going on here, make it over to the hospital to see the beautiful new hospital, talk with the administration over there about some of their work. And then I just visited with some environmentalists at the Willits Environmental Center. I'm probably forgetting a thing or two. Oh, yeah, we were at Metal FX, one of your great small businesses here in Willits, to hear about their incredible growth in the manufacturing space, which is kind of unique because we hear about a manufacturing recession nationally. But here's a company right here in Mendocino County that's thriving and sort of struggling because of its success, having a hard time finding housing for its employees. And we talked about their desire to grow in place, but some of the challenges that are inherent in that when it comes to a high-cost real estate market and a place like Willits.
And I heard that you gave some recognition to the hospital. Can you talk a little bit about what you presented them with?
Well, I presented them with a statement that I entered into the congressional record because they recently got one of the top honors you can get from CMS, which is the federal health implementation agency, on the quality of care that they've achieved. So really, Willits has a lot to be proud of, and that hospital not only looks great, it's a beautiful new building, but they're delivering great care.
And Adventist is hoping to take over the Coast Hospital. That's coming before the voters next month, and they'll take on quite a few concerns from the community, including a seismic rebuild of the new hospital and this ongoing debate about labor and delivery. So is that purely local, or can they count on some of your help from the federal level?
Well, certainly if the voters decide to do this, and I think it makes all kinds of sense, I'm glad that Adventist is willing to do this, then I'd be happy to support whatever grant applications they might seek in order to do this. That's kind of my job, is to go forth and try to find money for these situations. But that business partnership seems like a really good one, especially since, you know, they're already serving Willits and Ukiah.
And the money is a little bit of a segue to more of a regional question than a Willits-specific question. And as you know, we're having our elections in three of our supervisorial districts, including the first district, where Carrie Brown will be retiring. And she's been a staunch supporter of the Potter Valley Project. But you've been working on a two-basin solution for a while, and now there's a huge committee with a bunch of diverse interests trying to take over the license from PG&E. So can you give us an update on that?
Well, I can. And let me just say, Carrie has been a terrific local government partner on all kinds of things, but her knowledge and personal connection to these Potter Valley water issues is really going to leave some big shoes to fill. Thankfully, I think there is a pretty broad group of stakeholders now that it's invested in the success of this two-basin solution. And my job, having convened this ad hoc group that is helping to steer that, is to just do whatever I can to keep it on track and let the planning group parties who are doing the hard work of developing these studies and applications to the federal regulators to try to take over the license. We're sort of a support group for them. And I'm confident that whoever wins that supervisor's race will understand the importance of continuing that work. We've really got to get this one right.
And one of the questions I'm planning to ask these candidates is where they expect to find the money for the ongoing operations of the project, which are unknown, and of course, the studies that will have to continue to be done. And I don't know if that's really a fair question for a local supervisor, but maybe you could also chime in on that.
Well, it's a fair question for me, since I, you know, have been riding this bull for a while. Here's the short answer. Some of that money will come from PG&E, because they are the current owners of this project. They are trying to walk away from it and divest themselves of a not very lucrative hydro project that carries with it a lot of liabilities. They're going to have to pay into whatever entity and whatever plan emerges from this as part of the conditions for their exit. I can't tell you exactly how much, but some of this will come from PG&E. There also should continue to be a revenue stream from the hydro operations of this project, even if there's modifications that, for example, might include the removal or the modification of Scott Dam. You can still have a run-of-the-river diversion that generates hydropower and revenues from that hydropower that could help pay for some of this. And then, you know, this is a tougher conversation to have, but the folks in the Russian River Basin who have been the beneficiaries of this diversion for the last 100 years or so, in many cases haven't paid for their water, or paid very little for their water. We're probably going to have a tough conversation about that. And there will need to be some financial contributions from the water recipients. But there's new revenues that begin to come into play if we can keep this unwieldy, diverse group of stakeholders together. And that includes tribes and environmental interests and fishing groups. If you can bring that kind of super broad-based two-basin coalition to the table, you can open up public dollars at the state and federal level that can, I think, bridge the gaps and help make sure this thing is viable.
And another larger regional issue that you've been working on is the fisheries on the coastal parts of this county and the whole North Coast. And that's another tough line to walk between people trying to earn a living through some industry and environmental concerns like whales getting caught in crabbing gear. So can you talk a little bit about your work to balance those interests?
Yeah. So with respect to the whale entanglements and the limitations on the crab season, that's the crab fishery is a state-regulated fishery. It's not a federally regulated fishery, so it's not directly involved in the work that I'm doing on the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which is the federal marine fisheries policy framework. The federal issue there is the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act, which get implicated when you start entangling whales. And that led to a settlement of a lawsuit by an environmental group that curtailed part of the fishing season until we can figure out ways to reduce those entanglements. I'm not directly involved in it, but I have been tracking it very carefully. And what I will try to do is make sure that the federal agency involved, NOAA Fisheries, is developing the science and data that are necessary to hopefully find both better ways of fishing that result in less whale entanglements, but also better real-time data and management so that any time that we can have folks actually fishing on the water, they're allowed to do that.
And the fishery's been declared a disaster a few years ago, and the crabs apparently were really underweight, and fishermen have really taken a huge hit. So what are some of the efforts to help people who might be facing another disaster in the fisheries?
Well, fisheries disasters are tough enough for the folks who make their living on the water or who work with people who make their living on the water. What makes it even harder is when it takes 3, 4, or 5 years for that disaster relief money to actually get out the door. And that's the part that I'm working on right now. We can really streamline this process, cut it down to a matter of months or maybe, you know, 1 year at the most, instead of this terribly long period. I mean, most folks who make their living on the water don't have huge amounts of cash sitting around to get through a tough period. And so in the past, when they've had to wait these many years to get their disaster relief, some have had to sell their boats, some have had to move out of the area. And it really takes its toll on the industry and on these communities that count on working waterfronts. I'm definitely committed to streamlining and improving the fishery disaster process.
So if a fisherman went out of business while waiting for the disaster relief and sold their boat and is now doing something else, can they still collect that that check?
In theory, yes. If they're still around to talk with the state agencies who are actually distributing that money when it finally gets issued. But, you know, some of them have moved on and are long gone and may not even know about it.
And to move on to the other kind of disaster that the region has faced quite a bit, being wildfires, I understand that you've been keeping tabs on the FEMA disaster claim, and FEMA is the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and they would like to cash in on some of the settlement from PG&E because they worked pretty hard and feel like they have a right to that money. What do you think about that?
Well, it's an interesting and controversial subject. I was a little blindsided when I heard that FEMA was suddenly coming into the PG&E bankruptcy proceeding and laying claim to what is referred to broadly as a victim settlement fund. I thought that money had been negotiated with the victims and the victims' attorneys and was there to compensate people who have lived through all of the horror of these disasters. And it seems, you know, just at first blush, it seems quite unfair that FEMA would then parachute in and try to take a cut. I think there's a little more going on than just that, however. I think part of the challenge is that FEMA feels that as a matter of federal law, if there is a cause of a disaster other than a natural cause, that they're required by law to seek reimbursement. So I don't blame FEMA for seeking reimbursement. What I don't want to see, though, is them seeking that out of a victim's fund. I want them to go directly after PG&E for that money. And I think that would be just fine. I mean, and PG&E caused this, right? So it's entirely appropriate that they have to fully compensate everybody that's been hurt, including the U.S. taxpayers. And the state of California, by the way, has a similar claim that might be asserted there. So I am working with the parties, with FEMA, and I'm trying to do what I can to direct them towards some direct reimbursement from PG&E rather than taking out of this victim settlement fund, which, you know, victims first, as far as I'm concerned.
So you think FEMA should file its own claim separately?
I do, in short, but it may not be that simple. It's actually more complicated than that because the way this bankruptcy process set up the victims fund, it appears to have included claims of FEMA and the state government as well as victims' damages in the way the fund was set up. So FEMA is not entirely to blame for this tension that we have right now. And I'm trying to work with them to get this reopened and redirected so that the victims can get their compensation without competing with FEMA.
And there's another federal agency that stepped in to help clean up after the fires in Redwood Valley, and Sonoma County also had this issue with the Army Corps of Engineers where the subcontractors really over-excavated and just left giant pits on people's properties, and Cal OES had to step in and try to clean up as best they could. And I'm wondering if there's any accountability for the Army Corps of Engineers and if we are going to be at their mercy again.
Well, on the again part, I think all of us want to make sure that we never again have to go through a terrible disaster like this. But if we do, you know, the Army Corps of Engineers did contract out this clearing and excavating and debris removal process in a way that led to some problems. And I think we understand better now how to avoid that if we have to do it again. You don't pay people, you know, on a volume-based compensation scheme so that they're rewarded the more material they remove from a site that's been damaged. You take only the debris that is necessary to remove, and you don't dig big pits. But I think this is probably just something we're going to have to file away and make sure we don't allow to be repeated when it comes time to do the bidding and the contracting if this should unfortunately ever befall us again.
So is there any effort at the federal level to improve the oversight? Because one of the things that we faced with the Army Corps was that their commanders and the bosses would sort of cycle in and out. And so the new guy would be just kind of at a loss for answering detailed questions. And it took a lot longer than a lot of people were expecting.
That's kind of inherent with the Army Corps of Engineers. Their regional commanding officers rotate on a two-year basis all over the country, so it's constantly challenging. But if there are individual cases where homeowners have been damaged and we haven't been able to make it right through Cal OES and through the Corps of Engineers, folks should call my office. I mean, we have on an individual basis been able to advocate for people and in some cases make sure that the company that the Corps contracted with comes back and makes it right.
And I'd like to just leap over into another federal issue, which is cannabis. And of course, driving into Willits, I'm sure you saw plenty of billboards advertising clones and various, you know, we buy pounds. And the cannabis industry is thriving in Willits, apparently. But of course, it's still a scheduled narcotic, according to the federal regulation. And I'm wondering if you're working on kind of chugging that through the system.
Definitely. So I am co-sponsoring legislation on the range of reforms we need to make, starting with the incremental ones like giving access to the banking system, access to the postal system, various other incremental reforms, but also the big reform, descheduling cannabis so that states can simply call the shots and the federal government gets out of the way. I'll keep supporting any and all of that, and we're making progress. This year, in a bipartisan way, out of the House, we passed the safe banking reform that would provide access to the banking system. That at least gets this highly unsafe money laundering inducing cash economy reformed a little bit and lets these folks who want to run legal businesses actually use banks. That's pretty necessary if you're going to try to be legal.
Yeah, and it seems like the illegality of it and the bans on studying it sort of set people up to be easily duped. There was a company that was claiming that it had the ability to use CRISPR to edit the cannabis plant, but some of our most eminent plant biologists at UC Berkeley tell us that, you know, they're still at the stage of trying to figure out how the genes in plants express themselves, but how would you even know if somebody's studying cannabis? So are there any projects in the works to at least study it so that we can verify some of these claims about this miracle drug?
Yes, ending this wrong-headed, don't even study it policy at the federal level is part of the reforms that I've been supporting at the federal level. And you're right. How would you be able, if you're getting ripped off by someone, especially an out-of-state business that is hawking some, you know, fake CRISPR technology, you're not exactly going to go to the FBI or the Department of Justice to achieve justice in that situation. So if we can deschedule cannabis, almost all the other problems fall away. At that point, it's just another business, and you would have access to the same consumer protections and banking and use of the postal system and everything else the way it should be.
Are you getting any traction with your colleagues on these ideas?
Well, definitely. No, the fact that the banking reform passed with a really good bipartisan vote is the best indication of where we are. We could pass a bill to deschedule cannabis outright out of the House and I think out of the Senate if we were allowed to have that vote. So we just got to keep pushing. The pressure is building. A significant majority of Americans right now live in states where cannabis is legal, either medicinally or recreationally. So we're way past the tipping point, and Congress is just in the process of catching up to where the country really is on this.
And I want to get to the reason that we're recording this interview instead of having it live and letting listeners call in and ask you questions personally. And that is that there's an impeachment going on.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the work that you have done to try to keep the co-equal branches of government equal. And I'm thinking about some of your words lately about trying to limit the War Powers Act of the president.
That's part of it. It feels like on several fronts, we are fighting to reassert the authority and the relevancy of what should be a co-equal, directly elected branch of the United States government. Congress has abdicated so much power to the executive. And this is even going back well before Donald Trump. This started with the Bush administration and these very broad authorizations for military force following 9/11. They're still on the books and they're still being used to justify wars all over the world with the most tenuous connection to those original authorizations. So just last week, we were able to pass a repeal of those stale military force authorizations. And prior to that, we passed a War Powers Resolution making it clear that the president does not have authority to take us to war in Iran. So we're going to keep doing those things in the House. I hope the Senate will follow suit. Is any of this veto-proof? Certainly not. But I think it's important that the administration and the American people know that there is no congressional authorization if this president decides to, you know, launch new military adventures, which could happen for reasons that, you know, are not entirely on the level. We know how this president operates, and it's probably more important now than ever that Congress take these actions and make these statements to try to put some sideboards on President Trump's authority.
And a question about the impeachment. I know that for about a minute and a half, John Bolton was this completely unexpected liberal beacon of hope. But it seems like everyone has expected an acquittal from the very beginning. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on what the process was for and what's next.
You're right. The odds were always stacked in favor of an acquittal. But what we have seen, I think, should be jaw-dropping even to those who expected at the end of the day for the president to be acquitted, because this Senate shut down any meaningful search for the truth and did it on the most craven partisan basis, with John Bolton out there literally begging to come and tell the whole story, which would have been deeply incriminating. The Senate continued to say, we don't even want to know. We just want to look the other way and vote with our president because this is our tribe and this is the cult of personality that we have now become. So I think what this means is there's an obvious message to the American people. If you believe, as I do, that this president has to be subject to accountability, that the rule of law matters and that checks and balances matter, and you just saw that the United States Senate doesn't care and isn't willing to do its job, then you need to work harder than ever in the 2020 election, because that may be the only way to hold this president accountable. And I think that message is going to be the big takeaway for a lot of the American people. I don't think that helps Donald Trump. I think what we've done is expose the deep tribal partisanship that has taken over the Republican Party. And I think the voters of this country don't like it. And you can see that from the public opinion questions on, you know, should we have witnesses and documents in the trial? Overwhelmingly, just from a sense of fair play and basic justice, these Senate Republicans are deeply out of touch with all that. And there should be a political price that attaches to it.
So can you give a rundown on some of the other things that you're working on? And I know that the environment and waterways are a big concern for you. I'm thinking about the EPA rules just rolling back water protections that were put in place in the 70s. Is that a done deal, or do you have work to do?
We've got a lot of work to do. So this president, for all of his incompetence on many fronts, has been incredibly effective at pulling the threads of environmental protection out of our system of laws and regulation and policy guidance. And it's going to take, in some cases, years to unwind the damage. Some of it you can do right away. On day one, the next president can get us back in the Paris Agreement. On day one, the next president can use executive orders and other authorities to begin to reset the balance in favor of environmental protection. But you mentioned the Waters of the United States rulemaking under the Clean Water Act. Just by virtue of the rulemaking process, it could take quite some time to unwind that and to get back to something like where the Obama administration had left off. And for those who wonder what the heck we're even talking about, because this is very technical and arcane, it's pretty simple. The Clean Water Act attempts to provide protections against water pollution. You can't really do that unless you define what bodies of water are quote-unquote waters of the United States subject to that law. And that's what the Obama administration attempted to do, set a real science-based standard. You can't just say it's the big bodies of water, the Great Lakes and, you know, the oceans and the major rivers that are navigable, because tributaries carry water pollution too. And if you really want to carry out the Clean Water Act, you have to define those hydrologic connections that allow you to fight pollution, and you can't do that without something like the Waters of the United States rule that they put in place. By throwing it out the window and basically dramatically lowering the standard the way the Trump administration is trying to do right now, you're going to take us back to the days when the Cuyahoga River was burning out of control for days on end. I mean, I just don't think this country wants to go there. So it's going to take some work to do a new rulemaking under the next administration, but it's what we have to do.
Is there a more lasting kind of protection? Because it seems like executive orders can just be undone by the next person, and we kind of just go back and forth and don't really have some kind of lasting policy about things.
It may be possible to codify something. That's going to depend on the election, too. I mean, if we get the right House and Senate, it may be that we can fix this legislatively. Or it may be we can use something called the Congressional Review Act, which is a way for Congress to override a regulatory proceeding and take us back to a prior set of regulations. Again, you need strong numbers to do that. You got to have 2/3. And so I don't know what this 2020 election is going to bring, but it may be that some of those options present themselves.
Well, we're getting close to the end of our time. So do you have anything that you would like to add?
There's really no shortage of huge things to talk about. I mean, I'm exhausted just from thinking about all the ground we just covered, and there's a lot more. The only thing I will add is everywhere I go, from the high school students I meet with to the tens of thousands now of people I have engaged in town halls over the last several years, probably one of the takeaways I have most is that people are desperate for a sense that we can get through this, that there's some hope, because they see a lot of darkness in this administration and the divisions in our country. And, you know, I don't want to be superficial about this. I don't want to suggest false hope, but I am continually inspired and amazed at what I see. I mean, these students at Willits High this morning were energizing. They are fired up and ready to take charge of their future and make a difference in the world. The environmental activists I met with just a few minutes ago are just full of resolve and purpose, and I see it all around us. So we sort of create my takeaway message for everyone who may be wallowing in the pit of despair is we create our own hope through the actions that we take every single day. And I want to thank all the people of Mendocino County for being part of that.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Congressman Jared Huffman talking with KZYX on his way through Willits earlier this week. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! At 4 o'clock and another special interview at 6 p.m. when Alicia Bales will talk live with 2nd District Supervisorial Candidate Mari Roden. I'm Sarah Reith.